on your key accounts, just a rough percentage of people waiting for dual sourcing from you in order to accelerate business?
The second source comes up, you know, in certain big customers, but what we're seeing right now is that they have such a tough problem to solve that really our solution is it. And we do talk to them, of course, about our, you know, added lines and additional lines that we can run their product on. We talk about, you know, a second facility with them. So I think that, you know, they understand what we're trying to do to protect the supply chain, but right now they have such a problem to solve that that really is not, it comes up for maybe a minute and then it goes away. So it's not a huge issue for us right now because of what we're doing here with the performance that we are enabling.
It does vary from customer
yeah.
to customer.
Yeah.
Certain customers, to Bill's point, a focus on achieving best performance. There are other customers that have internal mandates. And in that case, I think there's a combination of two factors, the lack of an outside source and fiber size. If we were bigger, as we get bigger, concerns with respect to the alternate source would diminish. But with some customers or potential customers, the combination of not having an alternate source and not being a billion-dollar company is a strong factor in the decision making. As Phil suggested, we have Trojan horse strategies to penetrate these customers, even if they are averse to doing business with Vago, because very often with Taiwanese contract manufacturers, we get solutions designed in with the building blocks for these customers. And you know, to their surprise, they found us to be their supply indirectly through
at some previous meetings, you had said that there'd be contingency plans for outsourcing backup.
Yeah, so we're having discussions with three different parties at this point in time to, you know, address this issue in different ways, with different business models. So we are mindful of the importance of making the most of logical opportunity in the marketplace. You know, people recognize that we have a saying in Italy, you got to beat the iron while it's hot, right? Don't want to wait for it to cool off. It becomes harder to shape it to advantage. So we're mindful of the fact that there is, the stars are aligned and we want to make the most of the opportunity. And certainly addressing in one form or another the limitations of being single source is part of the grander strategy.
So Phil did the heavy lifting. I'm here just to answer a few questions. I like it. Go ahead.
Can you discuss how the Kyocera agreement ties into all of this?
So we are they're actually going to come visit in the next few weeks. As I mentioned earlier, we just met within the last week with ASC. We see the packaging companies with ASIC packaging expertise as logical partners, right? Because historically, they provided solutions to their customers that, with our technology, could lead to a higher level of integration, including some portion of the, you know, power delivery, in particular the vertical power delivery, that resolves the outstanding challenge that Phil described earlier. So there's a role for our technology within their packages, and this symbiotic role for our technology on the other side of a board onto which their package with some of our technology is mounted. We don't view these as exclusive relationships. We view them as non-exclusive opportunities for synergy, where we can work together with respect to addressing their customers, our customers' needs, different customers have different preferences with respect to which packaging companies they've historically worked with. So there could be two or three of these kinds of relationships for substantial added value and technological capability. Go ahead.
Phil's presentation focused on, you know, reducing the resistance from the last inch.
Yeah.
So you go from sort of traditional to lateral to vertical.
Yeah.
You know, your customers, I'm sure, see the same opportunity. It seems that you have a different power architecture, a factorized power architecture.
Yeah.
If your competitors were able to design a package that put their regulators close to the AI processor, why would you still win?
Well, because we've been innovating for a long time. We're really adept at it. We understand how competitive forces play, and I think our advantage from an IP perspective is being the first, confronting the problem, solving it. And, you know, in my experience, when you're first at confronting a problem and solving it, you understand, you know, the intellectual property issues that relate to solving that problem. And I would suggest that we do a very good job of the analogy I like to use, planting a minefield for any unscrupulous competitor to try and walk across. And this is a multi-layer strategy in the sense that it's not one pattern. You know, once upon a time we got into IP wars back in the 90s where we only had a couple of patents. We did pretty well, but we had limited IP coverage. To compete with us on vertical power delivery, say 2 or 3 years from now, an unscrupulous competitor would have to get through a minefield with maybe 30, 40, 50 different mines to worry about. And that makes it very difficult to get across that field. So we understand, in effect, how the competition would want to come at it. And take vertical power delivery as an example. There are certain things that need to be done in order to make that work. Whether it's done with, let's say, a current multiplier technology or some other regulator strategy, the competition still has to go through the Strait of Hormuz with respect to getting to their destination, and we got that well covered.
It's a traditional buck converter.
Yeah.
Topology doesn't work as you go closer and closer to the processor. I mean, can it deliver?
So the traditional buck topology has got a number of handicaps. First of all, I don't want to get too technical, but it relies on an averaging technique to deliver the point of load voltage. In other words, what happens in a buck converter is that, in effect, you're mixing a voltage source at 12 volt or 48 volt with ground in order to deliver the low voltage that an AI ASIC runs on. That mixing technique has got limitations with respect to density, you know, efficiency, slew rate, i.e. the capability to respond to dynamic transients. So it's fundamentally handicapped with respect to achieving the current densities that we achieve. In Phil's presentation, you saw references to current densities that, you know, for best buck converters are in the ballpark of around 0.6 amps per square millimeter. You know, we are at close to 2, and that number is going to be increasing as we keep advancing the capability of our technology with 4G and new kinds of cells. So there are limitations with respect to this workhorse, what you refer to as the buck converter, which is this averaging device. So we don't average, we multiply or divide the voltage, multiply the current. So that's a fundamental advantage. And that's what we call a topological advantage. So it's the engine, the power processing engine, which is one element of a multifaceted solution to the challenge. The other elements are the architecture, the power distribution architecture. So the concept of, in effect, performing regulation away from the point of load and then using a current multiplier, irrespective of the topology of the current multiplier. That's another patented concept. So they can't do the architecture, they can't do the engine. And last but not least, the packaging technology. The packaging technology of buck converters is, frankly, very antiquated. You know, there have been advances that have been made, and you know, companies get creative. That level of creativity is to take an inductor and stick it on top of the package. But to reduce the footprint that it's occupied by the buck converter, but it comes at the expense of a pretty tall package, which then cannot get close to the point of load. Also, this inductor spews out a magnetic field, which you cannot do when you're close to a sensitive AI processor, because the magnetic field wreaks havoc with the innards of the processor, right? So there are really many, many, many different layers to this onion, and we understand it all because we were first at it, I think the competition has got a lot of catching up. It's more than making a better buck converter. It's again engines, architectures, packaging technology, which we continue to advance. So with the modern current multiplier, there was a major advance was first seen in NVIDIA solution. We have a number of other implementations now in lateral power delivery system. For vertical power delivery, as mentioned earlier, we're working with a number of companies to implement the first GCMs, which are geared current multipliers. And we're actually now working with two companies. One, we received a $3 million order from a month ago. And another company, which I think we're going to get a statement of work later this afternoon, and with whom we're going to be engaging very soon for an even more highly integrated solution, which involves, you know, three layers of packaging technology to achieve an extremely integrated vertical power delivery system. Go ahead.
Regarding your DC to DC power converter for the mild hybrids, how far ahead, Bill touched on that in his presentation, how far ahead of the competition are you in time?
We're way ahead. So we had Ferrari visiting us a week ago. You know, they use I'm pointing to Ferrari, not because obviously there would be a high volume customer. It's measured in millions of dollars. It's a few million dollars opportunity, but it's representative of the need, right? So in that particular engagement, the solution today with the latest Vehicle just recently introduced the hybrid vehicle with 1,000 horsepower that was recently introduced involves solutions based on traditional technology, which at the level of a few kilowatts of 400 volt to 12 volt conversion are about this big. You know, the weigh kilograms. That weight is an issue in a high-performance car. It's an issue in an efficient car, particularly with battery power that has got limited range depending on the weight of the vehicle. Our solution at that power level goes to the size of one of the building blocks. So we call it the 9223, which is a module that long, this wide. So we have, as suggested in one of the slides, when it comes to power density in the front end, an even bigger advantage than at the point of load. At the point of load, the density in terms of current per square millimeter is about three times better than the competition. In the front end, we're typically 10 times better than the competition in terms of size, weight, and generally speaking, performance. And what we have also, which is highly leveraged, is a modular strategy that can be extremely scalable, so that another maker with a multiplicity of vehicles planned in out years can, with the same building blocks, address the power system requirements, not just of one vehicle, but, you know, of the whole fleet, depending on which particular combination of modules they deploy. It's very scalable in terms of you need an extra few kilowatts, you add one of these 9223 building blocks. But fundamentally, the architecture stays the same. So all the qualification work, which is very extensive in automotive environment, right, because these are all extremely critical applications in many ways, safety is involved. That can be done once, and it'll be good for you know, power systems that use the same kinds of modules in larger multiplicity to meet higher power requirements. Go ahead.
Teresa, you talked about the vertical power solution, and I'm just wondering how receptive companies are to letting you into their package. I mean, I know that's a very intimate relationship, and you talked about how power supplies typically have a lot of electromagnetic noise that interferes with the CPU. So are companies really willing to let you into their package and onto their substrates?
So that's where packaging companies like Kyocera or ASE come in, right? Because let's say Google itself, as an example, would rely on either one or some other packaging company to get their ASIC, their tensor processors, or other kinds of AI devices, you know, packaged into a complete solution. So that's why the relationship with the packaging experts for value add that is synergistic with their capabilities becomes important, right? Because they have an opportunity to, first of all, be competitive relative to their peers that don't have that capability. They have an opportunity to sell a higher value solution. And so we are, in effect, enabling a capability that their customers value. So we're going to be working with one of these companies in particular to enable a first, which is a device that will demonstrate a 1,000 amp capability within an ASIC package, where we'll provide what we call a CLM, which is a load module, which is a module that we have developed in order to enable customers to test current loads up to 1,000 amps. They'll package the CLM within their package on a substrate with a gearbox underneath the package, and that will interface through a demo system with our MCM soldered to the bottom side of the package. And this will be a showcase for capabilities with respect to powering 1,000 amp ASICs, which are, again, becoming commonplace. You know, current levels of this order of magnitude, which I think as recently as a few years ago, would have been to many, including myself, hard to envision, are becoming common denominator. Because fundamentally, AI and having a great deal of computing capacity, it revolves entirely on current delivery. Without current delivery, you can't do it. We've had customers that, with the MCM package, thought about the possibility of, in addition to having an MCM, you know, sit on the back of their device, reticle, having two more at 90 degrees to, in effect, facilitate some incremental current delivery, which is not an efficient way of doing it. But it underscores, in effect, how critical to the performance and ultimately their capability current delivery is.
Yeah, it sounds like the fact that they're even letting on their substrate is a real testament to your technology. Yes. I mean, I can't even imagine some of these companies would even talk to anyone else about putting something on the substrate so close to the processor because of all the problems that it could introduce.
Yeah, so we've had to demonstrate to some of these customers that proximity of our current multiplier to their sensitive ASIC does not present noise or signal integrity issues. We've done, so for instance, Intel did a study of our solution and compared it to the back converter with an inductor and did the EM electromagnetic interference scans that in effect like some ultrasound machines, show an issue by having some deeper color of red. And the compared solution with a back converter and inductor spewing out, magnetic field is very red. Our solution is not red at all. So we can be a lot closer to the device being powered because our engine is soft switching and does not generate electromagnetic interference. Also, our package, our advanced package, is metallized on the outside. Again, we got a P on all of that in the packaging technology. And that metal shield contains, any low-level magnetic field. There was reference earlier to an aerospace application, a satellite application. The first satellites are going to be going up next year with our technology. We're now starting production on these first satellite applications. There too, the enabler was the very low noise performance of our solution. It's much lower noise than any competitive alternative. So proximity to the point of load is something that we can provide without creating the kinds of issues that competitive alternatives present. Go ahead.
The long-term gross margin goal of 65%, is that largely a function of sort of existing advanced products becoming a bigger percentage of sales, or is it dependent upon the newer advanced products going into auto and satellite becoming X percent of sales?
So I think it's a combination of a number of different factors. So I would say first and foremost is the scalability and the leverage associated with absorbing what has been largely fixed cost structure, right? Higher volumes in and of itself will do wonderful things with respect to margins. With the packaging technology, we have an inherently very cost-effective solution, in part as suggested earlier by Phil, because unlike the competitive alternatives that get manufactured typically, one up, we make these things in panels. And the panel is about that big. If it is a point-of-load device type of panel, it may have 40 or 50 different chips. If it is, something that would provide 400-volt conversion for a vehicle application, there would be fewer because those are larger building blocks. But whether it's one or the other, we can leverage the same manufacturing process steps, the same tooling, in effect, depreciate that equipment across a larger quantity of devices. So I think first and foremost to the margin story is the revenue story. And obviously, that's the revenue story that is still to materialize, right? To set things in the proper perspective, the last 6-9 months have been difficult, right? Given a variety of factors, slow spending, with respect to the data center, the Chinese tariff situation, which has been very complicated. But as we see our way past these headwinds and we begin to capture volume for these new applications where we've recently gotten significant design wins and early applications for which we have gotten design wins in the last year or two, the economies of scale will, by themselves, do wonderful things to the margins for the advanced products and the margins for the corporation as a whole. The ability to mix in solutions for applications that value the technology more than routine applications is another factor. In other words, we're very sensitive to selling value. You know, we've obviously invested a great deal in getting the technology and the product capability to where it is. You know, that investment is a $400 million investment. Over the last 10 years, you know, with the R&D level, the way it has been, we're very keenly focused on getting return on that investment and obviously getting the margins to where they belong for a company with the level of IP that we have and the proprietorship in the products that we have is of paramount importance, and it's quite doable. I mean, there are a number of companies in the semiconductor industry with a lot less technological content, you know, very distinguished companies with a fantastic financial track record, don't get me wrong, but I guess weighing ourselves against them in terms of IP and technological content, I think we're up here where they're there. But in margins, they are 75%, which demonstrates that that can be done if the conditions are right. Please.
How do you see the U.S.-China tariffs and now the U.S. Export controls on high-tech semiconductors affecting your business going forward?
I mean, to be honest with you, it's been disruptive, and I'm frankly concerned that the genie has come out of the bottle and there's no putting it back in some respects. You know, I think in China in particular, there is a policy of localization that has been, that was in place to some degree before the last year, but now it's in full swing. For obvious reasons, because fundamentally these companies or nations cannot put themselves in a single source dependency from a U.S. company that could be precluded from being able to sell products, right? So what has happened has had an impact on, you know, our bookings, you know, from China over the last 6-9 months at a growing rate. And even if the leaders meeting tomorrow kiss and make up, it is unlikely to bring back the status quo ante before all of this began to happen, right? I think there's going to be a permanent impact. The good news is that we have outstanding technology. In China, we historically sold a lot of bricks, old stuff. In recent years, we got a lot of new design wins with the advanced products. There's really nothing that comes close to that, and those forces will keep us in a lot of applications, you know, short of outright bans, right? It's an unfortunate situation. There's no question about it.
Could you elaborate a little more on Phil's slide on your Generation 4 new products and how that further extends your lead in the marketplace? Can you just talk a little bit about that further?
Yes, so what we call 4G, which can be confusing, or Generation 4, which is perhaps less confusing. People wonder sometimes, why are we introducing 4G with 5G? But it's a fourth generation of control system technology. And that's the culmination of a great deal of continuous innovation with respect to both our regulator engines and how they are controlled, the sample converter current multiplier isolation stage for a voltage engine and how it's controlled. And fundamentally, The advances have to do with lower cost because of higher level of silicon integration. So there's a lot of parts that come out. Take as an example the NBM, which is a hot seller. We got a growing list of marquee customers for NBMs. We got designed in with an older control system. The NBM with the older control system has got about 125, 130 parts, distinct parts within that small package. The 4G or fourth generation control version of it has got 80 parts. So you take 40 parts out of the assembly, there's quite a bit of empty real estate. The cost comes down, the assembly time comes down, the bill of material cost comes down. At the same time, the performance goes up. The performance goes up because... the performance goes up significantly because the new controller has got adaptive features and control features that, in effect, extract more performance out of the engines by introducing new modes in which the engine can operate. So a loose analogy would be, what happens in vehicles that when you come to a stop, turn the engine off before electric cars take over, right? With our control system, we do similar kinds of things to improve the performance of our engine in a variety of application environments. Ultimately, the biggest factor is the elimination of components that reduce the volume that is taken up by the solution, because that enables an even smaller solution in a smaller footprint. And that in and of itself is another driver of lower cost, high performance. So fundamentally, as we can reduce the size of the solution in a panel, we can get more converters. And with more converters, our cost, since our cost per panel doesn't go up, it actually keeps going down with the number of panels we make, with more components per panel, we get reduced costs. So it's the best combination of delivering high performance, higher density, and lower cost. You know,
and
higher efficiency. So, in the past, I've been asked when our cost structure was not as good as it has become or it's going to be, and we were perceived by the market at large as being a provider of specialty products with a high price tag. I've been asked numerous times, could you make this thing cheaper by making it bigger? And so people thought that it was expensive because it was small, and that made it complicated. And they were really missing the point, which is making it smaller with the right methodology ultimately makes it cheaper because it makes more efficient use of resources and enables you to make more per panel. I mean, these laws are really like the laws at play that have been at play in the semiconductor industry, right, for a long time. When within a wafer, going from 8-inch to 12-inch, but with advanced technology, you can deliver a solution with a smaller footprint, the smaller thing doesn't cost more. It ends up costing less because you can get more per wafer. And that's a methodology that the industry, our competitors, have not quite yet come to leverage, right? That we've been pursuing with our packaging technology.
And you're going to be porting that Generation 4 IP to vertical, lateral, and front end?
All of these things are interrelated. I think it's essential part of the strategy to keep making synergistic advances, right? Obviously, not all the capabilities are available on day one. You can establish, let's say, a presence or a beachhead with the capabilities that are available to you at one point in time, but the strategy is to continue to advance the state of the art, reduce the size, improve the efficiency. And improving efficiency is tantamount to reducing the size because you get less seats, so it takes less space to manage it. And ultimately, that's a lower cost card. And actually, with our 4G or fourth generation technology, we are filling a gap because going from the second generation to the third generation, what we did was focus their third generation control system at the point of load for good reason, because obviously we've seen some exciting things happening there, but that control system could really only handle a point of load voltages from 48 volt down. It was not capable of controlling, let's say, a 400 volt or 800 volt high voltage bus. So for those solutions, the high voltage, high power solutions, up to recently, we could only enable those solutions not using 3G, but still using 2G, which is two generations old. So the advance in control system integration is actually not a one-step advance. It's actually a two-step advance. It's a huge advance. And those are beginning to now roll out. If there's one more question, please.
Sarah, what do you, you've talked to us about the minefield of patents you've erected about around your technologies. Are you concerned that China may not be effectively blocked by that minefield because they'll just ignore them and steal our designs?
Yes, you know, obviously we're watching developments there with a great deal of attention. And we're concerned about that, but the protection is more than intellectual property mines that we planted primarily in the Western Hemisphere. It's also a huge amount of know-how that is required in order to make these engines, the control systems, the packaging technology all work and work together. So that level of insight is not available, and then we keep moving at a fast pace so that we're continuing to advance the technology, because in this field it's like riding a bicycle. You can't stop, you cannot stop pedaling, right? So we keep pedaling hard in terms of continuing to advance the technology so that we maintain enough of a technological edge so that, let's say, unscrupulous Chinese companies can't simply copy it. Let's put it this way to get quantitative. They've been making a concerted effort, a number of companies there, for many years to knock off our bricks from the 1990s. And to some degree, you know, starting 5-10 years ago, they were successful in some applications, particularly the ones that are not noise sensitive, to knock us out with products, solutions that are 20, 30 years old. Even with those, nowadays, they're still having a difficult time. You know, they can match them in terms of size because all the products, relatively speaking, are quite big. So when we get into this business, the figure made for power density was 1 watt per cubic inch. And we introduced a 25 watt per cubic inch product, which was, you know, more than order of magnitude denser. But now we are, you know, close to, in some cases, 10 kilowatts per cubic inch. So if a Chinese competitor wants to knock off a 25 or 50 watt per cubic inch solution, they can come up with something of that size. But the actual performance, particularly when it comes to noise, isn't all that good. So it's not just as simple as making something of the same size with the same pins to go into the same holes in the board, because you turn it on and it doesn't quite work within the system. So it's a complex challenge. But, you know, obviously IP hasn't been working for innovative companies in China. Maybe the problem is going to get solved. I hope so. But we're not relying on that to protect ourselves. Sounds like there's one more question.
Can you just comment on the status of the capacity upgrades?
So we got the permits. I think there's an appeal period that's coming, Mike, to an end. You want to say a few words about it?
So we have permit in hand from the town of Andover, and we're waiting out the appeals process, and that'll be July 11th. We're actively suiting contractors and interviewing for a selection. And theoretically, we should be able to break ground in September, start the construction or the expansion.
And finish when?
Depending on the need, I would say it would probably be realistic 12 months to 16 months to have it fully operational.
Have you ordered long lead time equipment already?
So we had the one round, Mike, maybe you can respond to that, but we had one round additional equipment investment. When was that completed, the installation?
Q4 and a little bit rolled into Q1. So we have our capacity that we think we need for immediate needs. It's quite a significant capacity improvement for the increase for the advanced products. And we're doing that all in the confines of the existing brick walls that we have.
So we're looking, before the end of this year, are getting the packing facility
installed. That would be the first breaking ground, yes.
And that sets the stage then for building up the expansion, which is about 85 or 90,000 square feet.
A little bit over 90,000 square feet,
yeah.
So you had a good table in the presentation you should just emphasize. It said the existing facility can bring you to 500 million capacity, and this add-on brings you up to approximately 750.
Seven million. Feet, right.
That was
yeah.
a very good table.
Yeah, with the additional 90,000 square feet, yeah. And, you know, we're looking beyond that in a few different ways.
That's great.
Thanks very much.
Great job.
Have a good day. Thank you.